this is a verse I put in from Isaiah. Do not call conspiracy everything this people calls a conspiracy. Do not fear what they fear, and do not dread it. Now, there are allegations of conspiracy on both sides of climate discussion. I don't subscribe to either of those. Some people think that there's a kind of conspiracy by big oil companies to deny any link at all. Maybe there are, but I certainly don't subscribe to that. Some people think that the global warming discussion has been hijacked by people who want a world government, and there's a great conspiracy to bring us all under the heel of that. I don't subscribe to that either, so just to let you know where I stand. But there are allegations of that, and I just found this helpful. Do not call conspiracy what this people, what some people call conspiracy. And then do not fear what they fear, and do not dread it. Now, we want to be responsible for the environment. I'll come on to that later. We have been, I think, of one mind that as part of our Christian witness, we want to promote understanding, good care for the environment, because God loves it, so should we. But this fear that kind of gets ramped up so that young people are afraid to have children, so that depression is rife because teenagers and young adults fear the future. Well, whatever a Christian view is, that is not a Christian view. We believe in a God who it's not, we fear him. Fear him. And then you don't have to fear other things. You have to work for a better place. But the fear that's gripping this world, I think, is sad, and I think it's inappropriate. So, that's where I am. I've been there for 13 years. I work in a technical university where there's a huge program of innovation in energy, innovation in robotics, artificial intelligence, much of it driven in a healthy way by concern about carbon emissions and getting them reduced. And nothing of what I'm about to say is in any way meant to downplay that or to not rate it. That's just in case any of my superiors are watching. No, I believe that it's important that the work that universities like ours do to reduce carbon emissions is a good thing. But there's cash implications, and doing what's right is not always totally clear. Why am I interested in this topic as a university chaplain? Okay, so go back 40-something years. This is my PhD. Aspects of Late Glacial and Post-Glacial Environments in Southwest Wales. It's not a bestseller, but it was interesting to do. And I looked down this microscope for 3 years. I counted 250,000, approximately, pollen grains. For those of you who don't know, pollen has got a distinctive thing, sometimes by species, sometimes just by genus. So on the top left there, you have the little triangle with the three holes. That's betula, birch, and then I love the headphone ones. You know, that's the pine, pinus. And then grasses, this is a trick question if you know any, because actually it's like a football that's been imploded. It's meant to be a round thing with one hole in it, but the hole must have let the air out because it's collapsed, as you can see. Why did I do that? Well, I did it because you can then reconstruct vegetation, because you count the statistical amount in each layer of the sediment you're looking at, and that gives you vegetation, and that is one of the proxies for climate. So, just I had a few of these things. I'll not kind of go into any much more of the detail, but you do a core down and then you get the different proportions. And my work was just going all the way back from the last ice age, when there was just grass and sedge. And then you see the different trees coming in with temperature increasing. Yeah, and then I worked in Wales. I like Wales. I lived there for 13 happy years. And this is just to show that I did actually publish some papers. This is my most recent paper, guys, in 1992, so 30 years ago today. So what, yeah, and it was a slight change of field in environmental science to look at the big concern of the time, acid rain, Zauerregen, and upland Wales. And we had this huge project funded by the government, which I was latterly in charge of. I started off just filling bottles and ended up in charge of it. So that's my sort of claim to scientific background. But particularly on this thing, obviously I was looking at context of ice core, the kind of things we heard about yesterday, the delta oxygen 18 temperature record and so on as well. 97% consensus among scientists that about global warming. You'll have heard that, I'm sure. The word consensus is interesting because actually science doesn't work on consensus. If you look at the history of science, it's sometimes often the mavericks who have a new idea who tip things and change the paradigm. I just think, you know, to say people say, oh, well, there's a consensus that the Earth is round and not flat. Okay. But this is just not quite the same. And it's all depends what you mean. What is their agreement on? So there are points of agreement that I think every scientist in the area would agree on. Surface temperatures have increased since 1880. Humans are adding CO2 to the atmosphere. We saw the graphs yesterday from Doris. It's going up very steeply. CO2 and other greenhouse gases do have a warming effect on the planet. So there's of the whatever 95%, 97%, I think everyone working in the field agrees on those things. But there are some points of disagreement. And I'll just itemize some of these. How much of the recent warming has been caused by humans? Well, some say it's 100%. Others think, well, there's other factors. The atmosphere is very complicated. And so maybe it's 66%, or maybe it's around half, who knows? But there is disagreement on that amongst reputable climate scientists. How much the planet will warm in the 21st century? We saw the different projections yesterday. There are error bars. There are different scenarios in the different models. So exactly how much the planet will warm in the 21st century is not a point of agreement. Whether the warming is dangerous, we'll be looking at the rhetoric of this shortly. But this is a thing that's often mentioned. It's just probably in the last 2, 3, 4 years, the word dangerous has been used when it wasn't before. So is it dangerous? And then how we should respond to the changes that nobody disputes. How do we respond to the changes to ensure human well-being, to maximize human well-being? That's it. That's what we're aiming for. I think that one is the one I'm going to be kind of concentrating on in the rest of this presentation, how we should respond to the changes to ensure human well-being. And it may be that there are other paths other than the one that is promoted at COP and so on. Okay, talking of COP, let's go to Glasgow. Glasgow welcomes the world. I was very happy to be welcoming the world because I'm a native of Glasgow. And this is the motto of the city. And you see it says there, let Glasgow flourish. Now, because we're Christians, you might be interested that is the truncated version of the original motto. The original motto is this, let Glasgow flourish by the preaching of his word and the praising of his name. Amen. And the city council kind of snipped that bit out at some point. I don't quite know when. when it became, embarrassing. But that's Glasgow. And I thought you might like to see that. Glasgow, you may know nothing of it. It was the second city of the British Empire at one stage. Huge quantity of shipping was built there. That's all nearly all gone now. The QE2, Queen Elizabeth II, was built there. I remember the day it was launched when I was about 10, and there was great discussion about what it would be called. And I came out of the subway, and it said in the evening paper, "It's the QE2." So I remember that very day. And then, even as recently as when I was a boy, it was a busy port. My family are from Glasgow. My grandfather was the civil engineer who built the last of the big docks in the 1920s, the King George V dock. That's now filled in. But it was a thriving port. So now it's kind of rediscovered itself, reinvented itself. It's kept one of the big cranes that used to load locomotives, which went all around the world, steam locomotives, until about the 1950s. That was still on the go. And that there is where the conference was over in the COP26 conference on the left there. So Glasgow welcomes the world. Glasgow, the industrial past, it's also got a medieval cathedral, the 12th century cathedral, which is unusual because it's a Presbyterian cathedral. Now, there aren't many of those in the world. And it's because the Church of Scotland is the national church, so it kind of took over the cathedrals at the Reformation. And it's also got a very fine university established in 1452, which makes it the second oldest in Scotland and the fourth oldest in the UK. In Scotland, we love to say that we had four universities when England only had two. Just thought I would get that in. Just because I'm paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get me. So, St Andrews, by the way, you'll be wondering, what's the third oldest apart from Oxford and Cambridge? It's St Andrews, of which I am a graduate. And my father and grandfather went to Glasgow, and my son went to Glasgow, but I wanted to be different. Okay, Glasgow welcomes the world. Here it is. And you probably saw the TV coverage. There it is. We've got crowds and crowds of people. We had students going over there for the big march. One in particular, Johanna from Hanover, was there. Kind of going, this is from our Sunday service people, was out there. And all the thing that came for that. Huge crowds. But not everyone was happy. The COP, Greta Thunberg, the COP has turned into a PR event where leaders are giving beautiful speeches and announcing fancy commitments and targets, while behind the curtains, governments of the global north are still refusing to take any drastic climate action. And, she was also at the earlier youth meeting saying, all you hear is blah, blah, blah. You probably heard her say that. And I want to interrogate that statement because Greta is the one that is very keen to say, you must look at the science. She says, I only just follow the science. Well, let's look at some science to see if that statement is true. Here are the emissions records for the EU from 1990. And it seems that you can see there coming down from the left, emissions are down to below the 2020 target already, but may not be hitting the 2030. But whatever you may say, they've come down. Well, let's look at individual countries. Start with the UK. These are statistics from this project called the Our World in Data. That should say Our World in Data. Sorry, I must have typed that wrong. I couldn't cut and paste the link without it going to the link. So the Oxford Martin School, University of Oxford, and they've got data on all imaginable things, including things you don't often see. So here's annual CO2 emissions for the UK from 1750 onwards. And you can see, going up and up, and then a kind of a bit of a blip, the First World War and so on. and then massive high in the 50s, and then down. I want you to look at the numbers. So we're over 600 million tons maximum in the 1950s, and now it's down to just over 300 million tons. So whatever that is, it's not negligible. Okay. Well, let's look at another. This doesn't have the EU aggregated, by the way. I've nothing to object to about the EU. Some of my best friends are citizens of the EU. We'll go by country, and we'll just take Germany. It's a good one. So remember, that's 600 million tons. Here's Germany, slightly later starting. But boy, look at that. Way over a billion tons in the 1950s. And then some reductions down to, well, if they keep going, they'll just about reach 600 million, which is where Britain was in the 1950s before it started reducing things. So this is some reality, but again, a steep reduction. But let's go to India. Remember, we've got those two figures, the maximum of 600 million tons and 1 billion tons. Here's India, 2.5 billion tons. And that has eased off. That might be COVID too. Certainly, they didn't sign up to abolishing coal at the Glasgow COP. So let's not leave out China. China, 10, 12, 13 billion tons. And I want those figures up there because I think we need to keep this in perspective about what we can actually do in the global north. Sure, we can do things, we can clean things up, but it does get it into a bit of perspective when you see the massive amount that is currently going on. So COP26, there were the different NGOs there. This is a group called Interaction, which is, I think it's a coalition of all the major international NGOs in the United States. But you know what they say is kind of accepted, I think, by all the NGOs. And this is from their website. The deadly heat waves, mega hurricanes, flooding and droughts we've seen with greater frequency around the world will only become more severe and frequent. We know that climate-induced disasters disproportionately affect people in low-income communities and low- to middle-income countries around the world. So that's their perspective. And in Spain, these NGOs have taken the Spanish government to the European Commission with a complaint that not enough is being done. What about Christian groups? Well, really, if you look at these European Christian Environment Network, Arosha, John Ray, really they just say the same. So you might think, well, what's to discuss? Whether that is a strict following of the evidence or whether it's just kind of saying, well, the experts say this, so that's what we're going to do, I don't know. But government responses to COP, I think Greta Thunberg did have a point that there was an awful lot of rhetoric and promises and things like that, and PR, there was a lot of that. But was anything achieved? Well, I think most commentators said that the measures agreed by the governments were better than they had feared, but not as good as they had hoped. Many governments, let's not forget, still have not implemented what they agreed to in previous COP gatherings. So, coming on to the climate crisis. Now, some may be offended by that question mark, but it's the word crisis. It's not the warming that I've got a question mark against, but it's the crisis word. There is this changing terminology. And if you're like me, you've been following this for 30 years, you'll know that it initially was global warming until there was a kind of a standstill. The length of that's disputed. Might have been 10 years, might have been 15. And then the word climate change came in. So if it snowed in Toronto or somewhere that was not expecting it at that time of year, that was climate change. And if it was hot, that was climate change. Then more recently, maybe 5 years ago, climate disruption. And then coming more recently still, climate crisis, climate emergency, and the UN's latest one, Code Red for Humanity. And I just draw your attention to that because we did start down at the bottom. Now, maybe that's because things are getting worse, or maybe it's because there's a push to get people's attention because they had stopped paying attention. We'll leave that with you. You can see what you think. But interestingly, the IPCC itself does not use the words crisis, catastrophe, or even dangerous. Doesn't use those words. Instead, it sticks to scientific terminology and it uses the term reasons for concern. So going into that, really, a brief review of rhetoric versus reality. Rhetoric is very important here. Some say it's important to get people's attention. I think, as a Christian, I want to stick to what's true. So we've got this. We are quite literally, you know the expression last chance saloon from US Westerns? It means it's the very last possible minute. You're in the last chance saloon. And that was Prince Charles at COP. There he is at the COP meeting in Glasgow. And then here's another one. Humanity is about 5-0 down at half time, using a football analogy. And that was, now these are British people because of course it was in Britain and these were the ones that got the headlines. Humanity is about 5-0 down at half time, said the British Prime Minister. And then this is more shocking. The Archbishop of Canterbury, people will speak of government leaders in far stronger terms than we speak of the politicians who ignored what was happening in Nazi Germany, because this will kill people all around the world for generations. It will allow genocide on an infinitely greater scale. Now, I'm glad to say that the Archbishop apologized for that, because you can imagine the utter outrage that that claim generated. So he has withdrawn it, but he said it, and it was just symptomatic that rhetoric can get carried away. Yes, I've taken an extreme one there, but it's important that we can just try and interrogate the rhetoric and say, is this reality? Well, a good question. Let's have a look at this. We can see here. Well, we heard yesterday how the floods, the fires, the heat waves that have plagued the world recently are, for many observers, proof that the impacts of climate change have already become catastrophic. And we heard how in Europe more than 150 people died in the floods in the Rhineland. Tragic, shocking, of course. And in the United States, the wildfire season started earlier and lasted longer, raising hundreds of thousands of acres around the world. Hundreds died from heat waves. But look at the statistics of the last 100 years. This is global annual death rate from natural disasters by decade. Third one in is the 1920s, and the color coding is blue is drought, then there's earthquake, flood, and so on. Storm is yellow. And the scale on the left there is annual death rates from natural disasters per 100,000. So it's the death rates per 100,000. That's take account of population, has of course increased fourfold since the 1920s. And yet, as you can see, when we come down to the later figures, in that decade, in the 1920s, 5.4 million people died from natural disasters. In the 2010s, just 0.4 million died. And then globally, the five-year period ending in 2020 had the fewest natural disaster deaths of any five-year period since 1900. And you can get the source of that from the same place, the Oxford Martin School Project. And this decline, remember, occurred when there was a fourfold increasing of population. And the temperatures did rise by more than 1 degree in the last 100 years. There's no one disputes that. Temperatures have risen more than 1 degree above pre-industrial levels. Now, I think part of the thing with the kind of what I would call alarmist view is that everywhere the journalists choose the most extreme prediction. And to talk technically, the RCP 8.5, which is the, you know, it's sometimes called the business as usual. But it isn't business as usual because we're not in business as usual. We're already reducing things. But it gets labeled with business as usual. And then journalists say, oh, you know, 3 billion people could face near unbelievable conditions by 2070 and so on and so forth. People are more scared. They're not having children, I mentioned. Than they need to be. Climate change is a challenge, but we're not in the last chance saloon, if that means that we face some inevitable catastrophe. And we're not 5-0 down and facing ruinous defeat, as the politicians were saying. And we're definitely not facilitating a worse genocide than Hitler's. Well, let's look now at some failed predictions from the past. These are predictions from models of their day. The models have been modified. Rising seas could obliterate nations, UN officials. That's from the Associated Press, June 30th, 1989. And you may remember the government of the Maldives had a cabinet meeting underwater, just to kind of put that in. Could obliterate nations by the year 2000. See that? That's just been picked out from the text there. Rising seas, it was said in 1989, could obliterate nations by the year 2000. Mr. Gore, in 2008, and this is, I picked this because it's speaking to a German audience, 2008, predicted the North Polar ice cap would be completely free in 5 years from 2008. And he made this prediction to a TV audience during one of the previous COP meetings at COP15 climate conference. Then another former Prime Minister of the UK, Gordon Brown, this one from 2009. And he says, we have fewer than 50 days to save our planet from catastrophe. So you see what I mean about rhetoric versus reality. And I do get quite passionate about this because I don't like people to get scared. Fewer than 50 days. This is from 2013, from The Guardian, a liberal British newspaper. US Navy predicts summer ice-free Arctic by 2016. Didn't happen. There was a minimum in 2016, but then subsequent years it's pulled back a bit, which does suggest something of a cycle. So it goes up and down, but it's not unitrajectory, the ice cover there. Okay, environmental policy. I'm going to look at some wrong turnings that have been taken in the past. Wrong turnings, well-intentioned at the time, but which were actually not good. First of all, promotion of palm oil for biofuels. This is in Malaysia, where I had a son working for a few years. My sister lived in Singapore, and we had several holidays. We journeyed through the Johor province, and I was expecting to see rainforest, and I saw miles and miles and miles of palm oil. Why? Because it was brought in to promote biofuels, because that was the EU policy. We're going to push biofuels. There was unforeseen consequences in that it priced people, local people, out of food, basically. It led to an increase in food prices. But more importantly, it led to the felling of quite a lot of the rainforest. So the developed countries' drive for biofuel led to increased felling of rainforest for palm oil in Southeast Asia. Now, it's obvious, we always say, well, we don't do that anymore. But we did, and people believed it was a good thing. So I just want to bring that in as a bit of caution. The estimated loss, 2.3% of global rainforest cover. Doesn't sound much, but it's 5.6 million hectares. There are, incidentally, some figures going around the internet saying that palm oil led to 40% reduction. That's based on a misreading of some report by some journalist, and it kind of took off when it became unfashionable to promote palm oil. But I'm glad to say the EU Parliament overturned their previous policy in 2018 by banning the import of palm oil. But not everyone was happy with that. The Malaysian government condemned the ban as crop apartheid and green colonialism. And you can see why they said that, because they'd geared their economy to doing what the global north had asked them to do. And then suddenly we weren't doing that anymore. So I think that's just worth bearing in mind when we make grand statements about what the developing country should do or should not do. Then another wrong turning, diesels. I've been driving diesel cars since 1986. I like them. I won't be buying another one. I like the way they run. And they were promoted, I think, in every developed country because they had lower CO2. I never worked that out, because in Doris's presentation yesterday, I think you said that burning diesel is more CO2 than in one of your slides, but it was promoted as less CO2. And so now roughly half the cars in the UK, I think maybe in Germany as well, not sure, half the cars are diesel cars. And the unforeseen consequence there was the nanoparticles in the exhaust, which are deeply unhealthy. They actually get into your bloodstream. And now there's a huge move away from diesel, quite rightly. I'll be getting there myself as soon as I can afford a new car. But again, these were honestly promoted as worth doing in their own right and have now proved wrong. Wrong turnings in the past. Then neglect of other environmental problems. I'll not major in this because we heard it a little bit yesterday. Plastics, and that is in fact, I think, the same picture that I found as what you found, Andy. And of course, plastics are a concern now, but they weren't about 5 years ago. They weren't. Because all the oxygen in the room was sucked in to considering CO2. Anything environmental only looked at CO2, and now, thankfully, we're broadening out a little. Then what about the environmental impact of the drive to net zero? Lithium batteries pollutes water resources, leaves mining waste. We don't see that on the Tesla brochures. It actually increases CO2 emissions. How come? Well, the production of an EV battery weighing 500 kilograms emits over 70% more, the production emits more than 70% more CO2 than a traditional car. Now, of course, once it's driving, there's no emissions, of course. But the getting there is not always mentioned. Cobalt mining in Kenya, a big problem. There's big industrial mines, but there's also people coming, kids, child labor. Now, none of this is to say that we shouldn't be doing electric vehicles. It's just to rebalance the discussion. If someone takes a medication, say for high blood pressure, some of you may be doing that, some of you older gents, I don't know, then there's side effects. And everybody knows that. You get dry mouth, whatever it is. Now, that's not to say you shouldn't take the medication, but it is to say don't pretend there are no side effects. And sometimes, just possibly, the side effects get so severe that it's worth questioning the treatment itself. Then there's technical difficulties of achieving net zero. There we are, solar on the left and wind farms on the right. And I think it's good to have these things. You know, I'm not against them, but I'm just trying to rebuild the some perspective here. I think we need to be a wee bit humble and recognize the possibility of hubris in discussing this, that we're just saying there's this one possible solution only. We need to be humble because of the mistakes that have been made in the past about unforeseen consequences. Well, ongoing requirements for baseload, of course, I mean when there's no decent sunshine and when the wind doesn't blow. For a three-week period, 2 winters ago, there was no wind. In the UK, in Germany, there's no wind because of a massive anticyclone. And what do anticyclones do in January? Well, they mean there's no cloud cover, which means it's cold. And what happened? Well, in the UK, we had to fire up old disused gas stations and one coal station. Why? Why is that a problem? Well, firing it up from nothing is worse than keeping it running low all the time. You do need something for what happens when there's not enough wind or not enough shine. Some say it should be nuclear. Some say it should be gas. Just to take the case of Scotland, our small country of 5 million people, we used to have 2 big coal power stations. We now have none. We used to have 2 nuclear power stations. One was closed last year. The next one's closing in 2 years' time. What happens then? Well, we'll end up importing electricity from England, which will be used by gas. But we like to say in Scotland, of course, we don't use that. We're completely renewable. There is the landscape impact. This is Whiteley Wind Farm near Glasgow. It's actually it's the moorland behind where I grew up. Tangential, but quite interesting fact. I used to go up there as a boy for a walk with my New Testament. And it was up in the moors there that I first felt God calling me to ministry in later life. I was about 15 at the time. Well, there are now 215 Siemens and Alstom generators, 539 megawatts. We used to be the biggest wind farm in Europe, but we've been beaten by the Romanians. And Fontanelle in Romania is now bigger. But this is pretty big. It's so big you can't actually photograph the whole 215 because it would be too wee to see. You'd have to have a satellite. Technical difficulties in achieving net zero. I mean, maybe some of you think I'm a bit of a Jeremiah here, you know, like I'm just kind of telling you all the problems, but I'm doing this to rebalance the discussion ethically because there are downsides to any action we take. The ongoing requirement for baseload, electricity networks will need massive upgrading if we're to move to completely renewables. Well, why? Because the wind is in the north and west of Scotland, but the population in Britain is in the south and east of England. And if you do surveys of who likes wind farms, they do them UK-wide. And there's a massive bias, if you like, towards people in London and the southeast who will never be near a wind farm. Yeah, they're in favour of them. The people who are next to them, not so much. Although there are incentives that you can give in policy, you know, cheaper electricity for locals, and that's maybe a way forward. But it's not simple, electricity networks. Problems accessing charging points. I live in an area like this where you can bring your car in the front drive, you can plug it into your charger and so on. 2 miles down the road, 2-3 kilometres down the road, we have the poorest area in Edinburgh, Muir House Estate, highest incidence of multiple deprivation. But people do own cars, old bangers, dirty diesels, that's all they can afford. They can't afford a Tesla. And even if they could, there would be nowhere to charge them. Maybe we need, oh yes, we need more and more charging points, but you'll never get them in big flats. And how many would you need to satisfy demand? Maybe it can be done. Maybe it can be done, but not enough people are asking the question. There are downsides to on a technical level. The economic impact of net zero. There's impact on poverty in the majority world. We know about the impact on poverty from climate change. We know this thing that, you know, the droughts are really our fault. It's very difficult to nail a particular weather pattern on temperature or on CO2 itself. CO2 definitely is linked with temperature, but whether that feeds over into every bad thing that happens is less sure. But there will be an impact on poverty if the net zero approach is chosen, which is why India didn't want to impoverish its citizens by denying them cheap energy. Sorry, but they're doing more and more coal. They're going to be doing that no matter what COP says. And I can kind of understand why, because they look at the developed countries and say, well, you know, you have a high lifestyle based on cheap energy, and now you want to deny us that. So there are impacts, as well as the ones we hear of. Impact on poverty in the developed world. Well, I think Germany and EU will generally be roughly the same as UK, where there's going to be a doubling of fuel poverty by the autumn, this autumn. Yes, it's caused by Putin, but is it completely caused by Putin? Because of Putin, we had no alternative baseload. And I'll save our German friends' embarrassment. 43% of us in this group are German, 6 out of 14. But, you know, obviously there's been a huge turnaround in policy there. But there will be an impact on poverty if we pursue net zero without adequate backup. Geopolitical considerations, of course, Putin and so on, unforeseen, but that happened. But there's other ones as well. If we move all the kind of dirty stuff out to China, then China becomes more powerful. So what should then be done? What should be? Should nothing be done? No one is saying nothing should be done. The impact on poverty, I mean, if you think about a hurricane coming to the Caribbean, if it's possible that the impact on Florida would be zero deaths. It's conceivable, because they're rich and they've built resistant homes. The same hurricane goes to Haiti, and thousands can die instantly through drowning, and thousands more in disease epidemics like cholera. Well, what's the difference? One is rich, the other is poor. If we don't keep the economy going, then there's no way of getting Haiti richer. And that will cost lives. The richer the world gets, the better the world will cope. But many who advocate drastic moving to net zero have somehow taken against economic growth. And in this view, the Industrial Revolution, powered by fossil fuels, was our fall in theological terms. And the consequence is, according to the United Nations, extinction. Well, I don't buy that. I think we should try to get more people resistant to hurricanes by having things sorted. Well, I mentioned that there's a consensus on certain things, that warming is happening, that CO2 is rising, and so on. But I also mentioned that there were not consensus on the dangerous aspect of global warming. And one of the prominent scholars, who is a perfectly reputable climate scientist, is this Judith Curry, Professor Emerita at Georgia Tech in the USA. Now, she's an interesting person because she disputes the catastrophic thesis. She gets real grief. If you Google her on images, you'll see some hideous misrepresentations of her face. There's definitely an element of misogyny involved in those who basically hate her because she doesn't buy the whole deal. She is former chair of the School of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences, and As you see here, one of the top 50 women named in a recent survey in science, technology, engineering, and management. And she is not alone, but she has suggested some steps that could be taken, and she calls it Plan B. Plan A is the one that we're, I think, familiar with. Plan A is based on rapid reduction of CO2 as the only ethical policy option to prevent dangerous global warming. What we've seen, dangerous is not mentioned by the scientists not in the IPCC report. Well, why do we need a Plan B? Plan B, because really, well, despite numerous UN treaties, I mean, how many COPs have there been? Well, that's 26. Despite numerous treaties, CO2 is continuing to rise relentlessly. And by 2050, the CO2 emissions will be dominated by whatever India or China choose to do or not do. That's the fact. No matter, remember those figures of the, what was it, 12 billion tons versus the UK's 300 million tons, Germany's, you know. Whatever we do, that's what's going to happen. So apart from scientific uncertainties, the weakest part perhaps of the UN agreement is that it's dangerous. It's based on linking warming to extreme events, which is tenuous at best. It may be a link, but it's not proven. So why a Plan B? Well, what would a Plan B look like? Well, Plan B would look like it may make matters worse by increasing poverty and becoming technically unfeasible if we keep on Plan A, and with only, as I said, a barely noticeable effect on global CO2 levels. Plan B would keep economics strong and make sure that everyone was having access to affordable energy. And that doesn't mean doing nothing. It doesn't mean that. It means a broader plan. Dropping the timelines is what they advocate. And accelerate energy innovation, the kind of thing my university is doing. Better insulation, cleaner energy. Of course, we want cars not to pollute and have nanoparticles in children's lungs, but have clean energy and cheap energy that people can afford without plunging many millions more into fuel poverty. developing countries, they don't want to just survive. We hear a lot about they want to survive. They want to thrive. They want to have a better standard of living, and a better standard of living comes from affordable energy. So climate, by the way, what should the model be? Is the climate in 1700 got to be the same as a benchmark for all time? Well, I don't know. Why choose that? Climate is not an end in itself. It's got to be the object that we should be aiming for ethically is to increase human well-being. And my concern is that the Plan A, which is, move as fast as possible to get everything onto renewable, and my concern is that that will make people cold in the northern countries, and cold kills more people than heat does globally. Cold kills. And that in the developing countries, they will be kind of told again, like they were told with the biodiesel, told what to do in a way that it may not be helpful for them. Well, conclusions then. There is, it's an ethically complicated issue. There is a biblical basis for environmental concern. I think we've all been discussing that in the different groups. Of course, it's to do with stewardship. Which the word steward in English, by the way, it was the king's representative who looked after the place as if it was his own. And that's what we should do. It's God's planet, but we should look after it as if it were our own. We're doing it on his behalf. Now, the net zero plan does have many positive features. It's good that we're moving away from polluting vehicles. Those things are positive. But rushing to net zero does have significant negative features. And I almost never, if ever, hear about those. And they're important and they're significant and they have to be in any ethical equation. I think, that's really where I would leave it. Biblical basis for environmental concern, obviously we said stewardship, we've had others. There's a verse in Psalm 113, verse 7, which was in my personal devotions this morning, and it's this: God raises the poor from the dust and lifts the needy from the ash heap. I want to be part of that. I don't want to adopt policies which seem to be good, but may lower the poor further into the dust and may push them down the needy further into the ash heap, which is what I fear may happen. So thank you very much for listening. And I'll just mention a couple of resources. I have found this book extremely helpful. It's quite unusual. It's Richard Bauckham, the New Testament scholar, but he also does Old Testament in this book. And he's fully engaged that there is a problem with climate and we need to do something. But his whole approach really is that it's God's world. He pulls out different, particularly Old Testament passages, and gives them a fresh look, shall we say, about how God views his world. And the way God views his world is surely the way we should use his world. And then, for the sake of balance, I've got netzeroclimate.org, which is a website promoting net zero. And then there's netzerowatch.com, which is a website highlighting some of the problems with net zero.